Okay, so here we go. So as a monk who keeps his promises, I promise this morning I will talk about Satipatthana Sutta. So here it goes. And instead of starting at the beginning, I will start at the end. Because there is something at the end of the Satipatthana Sutta which really excites people. Where the Lord Buddha said, anyone who practices the Satipatthana, after 7 days, they should expect either Anagami or Arahat. That's an amazing statement. And I know many people, that's what it says, you'll be liberated if you practice Satipatthana, even for as little as 7 days. And now we have been meditating here for 7 days. So, and the Anapanasati is the same as Satipatthana. So, how come it hasn't worked? The first copy of the Satipatthana Sutta, which I read as a layperson, it was the one done by BPS, I think by Somaterra. And I remember reading the introduction there, that I think Somaterra, if I remember correctly, it's a long time ago now, that Somaterra and one of his friends, they went to Myanmar to practice Satipatthana, and after 2 weeks, realizing they weren't enlightened, they decided to translate the book into English instead, at least to make some use of their time there. But, what is going on? Is the Buddha wrong when he said after 7 days you should get some amazing results? And of course, the Buddha is never wrong. It was one of the reasons why I told that story this morning of old monks don't lie. If an old monk doesn't lie, then the Buddha, even more so, what he says must be accurate and the truth. And what happened? Why did that farmer, why did that lawyer, and the general and the king not find the treasure the first time? It was because they never followed the instructions. So anyone who's practiced the Satipatthana for more than 7 days, if they haven't become enlightened, or at least got some Magapala, it must be not that the Buddha is wrong, but you haven't been following the instructions. There is something you have missed. So, then we look at the Satipatthana again. And what is it we can have missed? And I gave one of the most important things that people miss, the Vinaya Lokaya Bija Domanasang. Having lessened, even abandoned, even not fully abandoned, but restrained those first two hindrances. That has to come first. And that is why the Buddha positioned the Satipatthana or the Sammasati as number 7 on the Eightfold Path. All those things which happen beforehand are almost causes and supports for being able to practice Satipatthana. You do need a great deal of right view. Maybe not perfect, but enough to give the practice of mindfulness a context. Why are you practicing mindfulness? And of course, you know, it is that you have the basic view, the basic knowledge that, you know, that things vanish, that things are suffering. So it's not being mindful to enhance your pleasures, which again is sometimes you hear from people practicing over in the West. If you are practice mindfulness, then you don't get so much stress in your life. So you can enjoy your work, you can enjoy your food, you can enjoy your life more. So the mindfulness practices which are now sold in Western countries are not for the purpose of ending samsara. not even for the purpose of realizing the truth. It's for the purpose of being able to handle the stress in your work, get promotions and make more money, or have better physical health. So because it is not founded in the right purposes, there's no right view there. Of course, that mindfulness is lacking a huge amount and will never fulfill the purposes for which the Buddha first taught it. And we have the second factor of the Eightfold Path, which is one thing which I always like focusing on, because I call the second factor of the Eightfold Path the neglected factor, Sammasankappa. And the three Sammasankappas, sometimes I don't even call it, they can even call it right thought. For me, all thought is wrong thought. It's never actually very accurate. It always misses the point, and it creates a lot of disturbances in the mind. So, to call it right thought, it just seems to be wrong for me. Your thinking has caused you so many problems. And until one can have some silence, those problems will continue, and the insight from stillness will never arise. So instead of calling it right thought, look at what it actually is. It's the nekamasankappa. Letting go, renunciation, abandoning, nekama. Because sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you talk about letting go, letting go, letting go. Where is letting go in the Eightfold Path? Right there. And Sammasankappa, the first Sammasankappa. The second Sammasankappa is Avayapada, non-ill will. And sometimes we have ill will towards our stupid mind. Crazy mind, crazy mind, crazy mind. Right, this meditation is it, okay? Mind, no wandering. No sexy thought. No going to sleep. Okay? That is ill will. And that's not the Buddha's teachings. Sammasankappa number two, Avayapada, is the same as metta. Maitri, kindness. So you're kind to your mind. That's what the Buddha said. And sometimes people say, well, if I'm kind to my mind, it will go all over the place. It will never practice. It will never get still. It will just wander around. It will indulge in this and indulge in that. But the Buddha never said it will anywhere. It's all about being kind. That is Sammasankappa. And the third one is Ahimsaka Sankappa, or the wrong Sankappa, Mitra Sankappa. No, Ahimsaka, sorry. Vihimsaka, I think it's in the Pali. It's the same as Ahimsaka, and of course Ahimsa was something made popular by Gandhi. It means non-violence, it means gentleness. So when you look at those three Sammasankappas, when you're practicing Satipatthana, it should be remembering those three things. We're mindful to let go, to renounce, to stop, to be kind, to be gentle. And if we add those three things to our mindfulness practice, then actually we are much more powerful and more likely to meet the Buddha's promise, the Lord Buddha's promise, and get something out of 7 days mindfulness. And of course we've also got the virtue, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Because you know in monastic life, if you said something nasty to one of your fellows in monastic life, it's not just a case of bowing three times and asking forgiveness. That stays with you for a long time. It's very hard to let it go. If you said something bad to somebody today, it comes back to you in your meditation. It's very difficult to be peaceful. And if you've hurt somebody, if you've kicked a dog, then it's very hard to be peaceful the next day. Sometimes that these things do have an effect just on our ability just to be mindful. You know, we can't direct the mindfulness goes on our bad acts of the past. Sometimes that's just what happens. And it's called remorse. It's one of the five Nivaranas, restlessness and remorse, the Kukucha. And lastly, we got the gentleness, because if you're too harsh on your body, for example, you don't sit comfortably, it means that aches and pains will come up in your body during the meditation. Your mindfulness can't go on the four objects of mindfulness of the Satipatthana. They go, oh, it hurts, it aches. Should I move? Should I not move? If ever that comes up, one skillful means which I develop and teach when I'm meditating, again, ache in my knee, say, or anywhere else in the body, first thing I do is just take my attention away. I just ignore it. And I just focus on whatever I was doing before. And if it comes up again, I ignore it a second time. If it comes up a third time, I don't know why, but everything in Buddhism seems to be done three times. So the third time, then I go to that pain. I just put my mind down on my knee and see if I can just gently relax it. And if I'm focusing, my mindfulness is going on the pain in my knee, then the first time the thought comes up, I can't stand this, I should move. I ignore that thought and keep working, trying to relax everything. The second time it comes up, I relax it. But if the third time it comes up, I have to move, then I move. I found that a very skillful middle way. You don't just move the very first time you get an irritation or ache in your body. You just ignore it, first of all. And if the three times, or two times you ignore it, the third time it's not going away, put your attention on that part of the body and see if you can relax it away. But if three times you can't relax it away, then you can move it. Because you get some great insights when you deal with irritations in the body. In Australia, where I live, in the months of October and November, we have not mosquitoes, but flies. Millions of them. Billions of them. And those people who have lived in my monastery know that as soon as you breathe in, a fly might come into your mouth. Do you break your precepts? Eating in the afternoon? Usually the fly comes out again afterwards, and sometimes it really likes exploring up your nose. So it's very difficult with the fly season over in Australia. So I was telling people, it doesn't do any harm. The flies in Australia carry no diseases, so they're perfectly safe. And in fact, they just tickle, that's all. And so one day I was telling people in one of my meditation talks that if a fly does land on you, just follow my instructions, ignore it three times, two times, and the third time, just go to the feeling, the little tickly legs going up your nose and going down again. Don't do any harm. Just let it be. And of course, what happens? My karma, if I say that, and as soon as I finish speaking, a fly lands on me, as if to test me out. But that's okay if that happens in your hut. But when you're speaking in public, people are watching you and seeing if what you say is what you do. So I thought, uh-oh, I better not push the fly away, or suddenly if it lands on your nose, try and blow it away. I was stuck with the fly. And it was actually not that bad, because my fly must have been a Buddhist fly, because it started at the tip of my nose, and it went round my mouth. Have a guess how many times? Three times. Circumambulation, when it completed the third circuit, then it flew off. And I learnt a lot from that. I learned as the fly was walking around my mouth that the edges of your mouth are far more sensitive than the top. So as soon as it got past this point and this point, it was okay. When it was on here, come hurry up, because that was really irritating. So you get a lot of wisdom with mindfulness. Not very useful wisdom, but wisdom nevertheless. So anyway, that's actually how I deal with irritations. And which is some part of the right effort, to make sure that your mind is actually calm, your body is reasonably peaceful, and not going to the extremes of just enduring, 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 and not just going to the extreme of indulging. You know, the first fly to fall on you, or the first itch to scratch. Except for one thing. I haven't mentioned this yet. If you're on a retreat, and you're meditating in a group, and you wish to cough, please cough as soon as possible. Don't hold it in. Because we have something which I call the volcano effect when you have group meditation. A volcano is this pyramid of mountain. And at the top of that pyramid, at the apex, is a big plug of dried rock. And underneath is all this molten rock building up energy. And it builds and builds and builds until eventually, it has to happen, it builds up so much pressure, it blows out the blockage, and there's a huge eruption, a great sound of the volcano erupting, and all this very toxic ash and gas goes all over the neighbouring villages. It's very dangerous. Are there any volcanoes in Sri Lanka? Not known, but there may be. Who knows? There may be one under Bandarawela. We're in the mountains. Who knows? But anyway, it's the same effect as when somebody has an itch in their throat. They don't want to cough. Instead of just doing a quick cough, which goes very quickly, they block it up because they don't want to disturb anybody. And the itch or the irritation builds up pressure. And it builds and builds and builds until the volcano erupts. And it's so loud. You can even hear it in the town down below. Extremely loud, and even worse, you cough and all this toxic stuff from your mouth goes over all the meditators around you. That's very unhealthy. So instead of waiting for the cough to erupt, I've seen this so many times, heard it many times, just cough straight away, get it out of the way, otherwise it will build up energy and it will explode like a volcano. So coughing is one thing. You want to do it straight away, please. It's only a small thing, but if you wait and try and hold it back, it's a volcano. So anyway, back to letting go, being kind, being gentle in the meditation. That's important. The precepts are important, and that implies all of the effort. You know the four right efforts, people? I'm surprised you haven't asked me a question about this yet, because people say, Ajahn Brahm, you always talk about letting go. Don't do anything. Open the door of your heart. What about effort? Especially right effort. And maybe I will talk about this later on if it doesn't come up in question time, but just in brief right now, it is the effort to renounce, to let go, not the effort to get things. Mention that beginning of this retreat, one of the powerful teachings of Ajahn Chah, just not a sutta, but just one line, which did change the way I meditated. Simple teachings are sometimes forgotten, whereas the complicated ones are the ones we keep thinking about. And this was a teaching, he said, you've come here meditating not to attain something. You meditate to let go. And that changed my idea of meditation, because I was meditating to get enlightenment, to get jhanas, to get somewhere in this life, in monastic life. And he was saying, no, you meditate to let go, not to get. Because at that time, I didn't understand anatta. I didn't realize that attaining things was just supporting and making the delusion of a self even stronger and greater and more powerful. Whereas, we're here to renounce, to let go of anything connected to a self, especially attainments. So, that was so important. It's the effort to let go, not to get, not to attain. And that's such a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful teaching, because every time I try and get somewhere, I just get tense. I just stop enjoying the moment, all the peace vanishes, and all the wisdom just disappears. But when I let things be, I don't try and get anything, but just allow things to disappear. I'm meditating to let go. Then all of those states which you read about in the suttas, everything you've heard here, they come to you. You don't go chasing them. All the attainments are stages of disappearance, not attainments. The word attainment, it doesn't really make any sense in English language to me. Just stages of letting go. Just landmarks on the route of disappearance. So anyway, so that's what the right effort is, of letting go. And also, stopping takes effort. It takes a lot of power to put on the brake of a car. That's what we have to do. So anyway, when you do those sorts of things, you are reducing your karma chanda, your wanting for sensory pleasures. You're not wanting anything. You're trying to let go of stuff. You are reducing any ill will. You are reducing those first two hindrances by practicing the first six factors of the Eightfold Path. That is their job, to reduce those hindrances so much that you can actually be aware of the body and the feelings and the mind and mind objects. Otherwise, you're just not mindful enough. And to give you another story of this, of what mindfulness is and how it is established, so you can perform the Satipatthana. These are the preparations before embarking on Satipatthana. And this is the story which everyone has been on a retreat with me in Perth, in my retreat centre, which is opposite our monastery, has heard. I went to Australia almost 34 years ago now, and it was very hard work because we had to build our own monastery. We didn't have much support, and people never knew what monks were. So why give money to monks or to the society which was looking after us when they didn't know who we were? Didn't know whether we'd be there for 1 month or 1 year and then disappear again with all the funds. It took us a long time to build up the trust of our lay supporters. So I had to do a lot of physical work in those early years. And please know that I wasn't trained as a builder or as a labourer. I was trained as a theoretical physicist. I was really up here. My brain was really well trained to do math and sums. And now I have to go down and use my hands. But it was very enjoyable and very useful. As I say, that simile which Ajahn Chah gave, whatever you do, give it everything you've got. And I took that on board. I really just did listen to my teacher and follow his instructions, not just like that farmer and the lawyer and the general. Ajahn Chah was an old monk, and I did follow the instructions, and it works. I can't say those things. So, there we are with our following instructions. And he said, whatever you do, give it everything you've got. So even building, I gave it everything I've got. And that's why when the building finished, I developed that effort, that totally giving myself to this moment and giving it everything I've got. So when I meditated, it was pretty easy. You can get back into those deep meditations again. So that's how we do everything we've got. But I was very busy. But obviously, when you're busy, you have to go to the shop. And I don't mean the shop to get a new pair of robes, Versace or Gucci or whatever, designer robe, anything which is good enough. But I mean to the hardware store and to the wood yard and every other place to get stuff. So I was always going up and down the road to our monastery 2 or 3 times a week. And Bodhinyana Monastery, where I live, is on top of a hill. Not a big hill, it's only 2.2 kilometers from the bottom of the hill to the top, and when you get to the bottom, it's like a plain which extends all the way to the Indian Ocean. And for about, I think this happened after 7 years since I lived in Bodhinyana Monastery, for those 7 years I'd always go up and down that hill in a vehicle. But one day, it was a pleasant morning and I had lots of time, and I know even monks need exercise. If you think I need more exercise, that is wrong. The reason I look fat in the middle here is not because I eat too much. Those of you who've been looking after my food, no, I don't eat that much. The reason it's come out here is because I've now been a monk for 42 years, and every year you're a monk, your compassion increases. Every year my heart gets a bit bigger. And my heart is now so big it can't push out anymore because of the rib cage here. So my heart is so big it pushes down and out here. It's a big heart. It's not fat. That's my excuse, and you are welcome to use it if you're overweight. Mr. Ajahn Chah was overweight too. Interesting. I think one of the other reasons is because, you know, being a monk, practicing meditation, don't worry about anything. And people always tell me that worry, if you worry a lot, you lose weight. So I should, if I need to lose weight, I need to worry some more. So give me some more things to worry about. But anyway, so I decided I needed exercise. I walk up that hill, I did 2.2 kilometers, not that steep. Nice morning, plenty of time, no rush, and as I started walking up a hill which I thought I knew very well, I could not recognize my surroundings. They looked totally different than I remember when I looked through the window of the car. And that was confusing. 7 years, two or three times a week, up and down that hill, looking through the window, and now it was a different hillside. And then I was so confused I stopped. I stood still and stared in disbelief, and like I'd been in shock. And as I looked to the hillside, not walking, but just staring, it changed again. And now I saw things I'd never ever seen before through the window of a car. Small rocks. The stream in the bottom of the valley and some of the tiny little waterfalls as it went over the rocks. Blades of grass, among which were small little wildflowers. Just the beautiful bark on the trees and the little bushes with their tiny flowers. And it all looked more beautiful than I could ever remember. And that was weird. But I just enjoyed that weird experience, gathering the data, and it was time to carry on my walk, so I turned around and started walking up the hill, contemplating, how come, when I've lived in this place for such a long time, it was like seeing that hillside for the very, very first time, and it looked more beautiful, and I saw more things than I've ever seen before. And then, having been trained as a scientist, the answer was very clear after a few minutes. It's just nature, it's just science. Your eye. Your eye receives the light on the back of the eyeball, which is called the retina. As the light hits the back of the eyeball, there's a chemical reaction. And images form, colors form. But when I was looking through the window of a speeding car, the images never had time to fully form. The chemical reaction was not complete. Before another image came up, pushed aside the first, and it started to form. Then another image, and another image, and another image. That was like looking through the window of a speeding car. the images never fully formed. I could not see all the detail, and even the colours hadn't formed properly. They were pastel, washed out, not full or rich. But when I went slowly, walking up the hill at a speed a car just cannot do, when I walked and looked, the images had more time to form in the back of my eye. I don't know if any of you did what I did in school, and we made photographs, and we developed the photographs on photographic paper in a tray of chemicals. I remember doing that at school. Obviously, these days with iPhones, you don't need to do that. It just comes up immediately on your screen. But in olden days, you'd put the photographic paper in the tray, and it would develop. And you could see the image emerging slowly as the chemical reaction completed. It took a couple of minutes, sometimes longer. And I remember just seeing this white sheet of paper, and then the images slowly coming out until it was properly developed, and you can take the piece of paper out and dry it. And that was similar to what happens in the back of your eye. Take it out too soon, and you don't get a proper image. Take it out only halfway, the colours aren't fully formed. So that's what was happening. So the more time I gave to seeing, the more I saw. So when I walked, I saw much more. But when I stood perfectly still, only then did the image in my retina fully form. Only then did I see all the little details. And all the colours were really, really full, rich, and beautiful. And that was what a wonderful simile for the preparation for Satipatthana. If you're going to be mindful, you have to go slow and be still. Otherwise, it's like meditating, looking through the window of a speeding car. You're going too fast. And what you see, what you hear, what you feel, what you know doesn't fully form. You don't see all the details. You miss too much. This is why the stillness and the slow mind are essential for mindfulness. Oh, and the other thing which surprised me, but now I know so well, is that when I slowed down, when I stopped and looked, then it was not only I saw more detail, but what I saw was more delightful. The old delight in meditation, the happiness in meditation, always comes from slowness and stillness. So if you want to be a happy monk, a happy nun, slow down. Be still. Don't think so much. Be calm. Be quiet. Walk slowly. Do things slowly. And you'll have more energy. And that energy will be experienced not in only greater mindfulness, but also in a natural delight and a greater happiness. And as I like to always quote Dhammacaddiya Sutta, I think I already mentioned this once, but here it comes again to reinforce the teaching. King Pasenadi, visiting the Buddha, remarking to the Lord Buddha how he enjoyed going into the Jetavana monastery outside of Sarvati, because the monks are always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, that is what you can expect when the monks are meditating properly and getting insights. And that was powerful teaching. If the monks are meditating and getting insights, they'll be happy and smiling. So, are you happy and smiling? Or are you miserable and upset? Why? Because you're not meditating properly. So said the Lord Buddha. Anyway, this is what happens. When you get still, everything looks more delightful. So, these are preparations for doing Satipatthana. He said, Vinaya Pitya Dhammanasang, Satima, mindful, Sampajana. What does that mean? Sometimes, and it's obvious if you know Sampari, Sampajanya means with wisdom, with understanding. That's why, I think this comes from the commentary of the Abhidharma, but the teachers like Ajahn Chah would never say Sati Sampajanya, would always say Satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom, always together. They would never ever use mindfulness alone. It'd always be Sati Sampajanya, but that was very rare, usually Satipanya, mindfulness with wisdom. And it's so important actually to put the wisdom with the mindfulness. Don't just be mindful, but be wise as well. For example, I once, many times, been to conferences, Buddhist conferences. And this conference, it was in Hanoi, and they had the Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh there with many of his disciples. I was sitting next to him. Quite frankly, he was very miserable. I wasn't impressed. But anyway, he was very mindful though. But his students, they had a session which happens in conferences these days, where you split up into groups, and every group discusses a topic which is important for Buddhism. You know, how to support the Sangha, you know, how to create just more links between the different parts of the Sangha, how to create harmony between the different Nikayas in places like Sri Lanka, and how to actually to make Buddhism stronger in the world, all different subjects. So everybody split up into different rooms, and they had one person who took the notes, who was going to report back to everybody once the discussions had been complete, of, you know, any good ideas they had, so we could all hear it. And for one of the groups, they chose one of Thich Nhat Hanh's disciples to give the presentation on the results of the discussions of one group. So once the MC, the person in charge of this session of the conference, he invited, "Would Venerable so-and-so please go up to the lectern to present the findings of your group." And so this nun, she was an American nun, she got up from the seat really mindfully and very slowly. And she turned around with the mindfulness of that tradition. And as she lifted her right foot, she was mindful of every part of the movement until the left foot or the right foot went down the ground and then the left foot. Everybody had about 20 minutes to make their presentation. She used half of that 10 minutes just to get to the lectern. And monks like me were laughing. Well, I was quite restrained. There was a Tibetan monk sitting next to me, and he was laughing so much. He was totally, you know, impolite. Laughing at this stupid nun, and you must call her stupid, you know, walking my feet to the lectern. As soon as she got there, okay, that's it, time to come back again, no report. Because we only had 20 minutes each. So that was sati, mindfulness, really good mindfulness, without any wisdom. That was sati with moha, with avijja, with stupidity. So mindfulness must always go with that wisdom. So that's why you have sati sampajana, atapi. You know, that determine. This is what, you know, you're doing. And again, vinaya lokeya pitya dhammanasang. The big part of the hindrances, you know, you've dealt with them. Then you can do some satipatthana. And then maybe in 7 days it works. So let's say the four satipatthanas, the body, feelings, the mind, and the mind objects. And first of all, I don't know if this happens in Sri Lanka, but in the West, people keep on saying, oh, you do the body, the feelings, the mind in the mind. Look, that's just the anomaly of Pali. If you ever just read the suttas or the Vinaya in Pali, you do past reaping of paths. You do egg cooking of eggs. You do body sweep. No, I did the body sweeping already. You do camera photographing with a camera. They always repeat the words. It does not mean anything other than just being aware of the body. It doesn't mean anything else. Really bad translations. As if any of you do any translation work, never translate word for word. Always translate phrase for phrase. Get the meaning of the phrase and then translate that. That's why, as I already mentioned, have these really weird idioms in English. It rained cats and dogs. You don't translate that into Sinhalese. You translate it just rained heavily. You translate phrases, not words. So anyway, that's why kaya, kaya nupasi, just means aware of the body. And there's many ways to be aware of the body, and of course, the first way is to be aware of the breath. It's part of the body. And you can do all the other awarenesses of the body, such as the super meditations. If you can, find a dead body. It's very hard to find a dead, rotting body these days. But, I'm not sure in Sri Lanka, when I was a young monk in Thailand, we could just go into the autopsies. Have you been to autopsy yet? You can go, excellent. The first time I went to an autopsy, this was in Sirirat Hospital in Bangkok, which is just over the river from central Bangkok. And I got there early into the autopsy room, like a lecture theatre. No one was there. And I couldn't believe it. On the windows were very high windows, so no one could look in. And on one of the shelves, on one of the high windows, there was, instead of a pot plant, which, you know, usually they put in such places or a photograph, there was something which looked like a human head on a plate. And I went up there, and it wasn't fake. It was a real human head. They must have run out of flowers, put in pots, and they just got a head from one of the autopsies on a plate, you know, one of these ceramic plates, and just put the head on the top there, next to the window. To me, always liked weird stuff. That was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. You could pick it up, look at it underneath and around, it's a dead head. So that to me was really good, a super. But the best of supers, because when you actually cut up a body, it didn't mean so much to me. Because it was just too interesting. Not at all sort of averse to it, but just fascinated by the science of it. But when I went to an autopsy of a young man who was exactly the same age as I was, now that was more interesting because you could identify with it. And when they couldn't actually find out why he had died, so they're looking at all the different organs, and in particular, I never knew you could do this, you know, he pulled out this man's testicles from inside. And that really, really sort of made an effect on me. Ooh. It did. It was really. Because you could identify with that corpse there. So sometimes, if it's a super, you need to identify something there. Otherwise, it just becomes a game. You know, many, many monks, who a super was one of their main types of meditation, but it never really worked. They disrobed. They used to contemplate the disgusting features of a human body and ended up marrying one. But how do you do this? For young monks in Australia, I teach them just, you know, when ordination happened to you, it's throughout the world, in ordination, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. And I always wonder why. Why those five? For the meditation you learn when you first ordain. And then you contemplate it, hair of the head. The hair which you see, say maybe beautiful girl's hair, it's all dead. Because hair is dead stuff. The live part of the hair is actually under the skin, in the root. That's why you can sort of cut a hair, you can burn it, it doesn't hurt at all. There's no nerves, it's dead. Sometimes other hair of the body, you know, your beard, or under your armpits, that's all dead stuff. And same with nails. That is dead. The nail you see here is dead. Like the hair, the root is under the skin. And the teeth, that's all dead too. the root, you know, as any dentist knows, is underneath the tooth. And lastly, the skin. The skin, you see, again, is all dead. The live part is, I think, a millimetre underneath that skin. That's where the live part of your skin is. So, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. You monks, if you see the most gorgeous girl, what are you seeing? Dead hair, dead nails, dead teeth, dead skin. Who would want to stroke dead stuff? Ugh. Who would want to kiss dead skin? Ugh, that's sick. Same with nuns, if you see a beautiful guy, what are you actually seeing? All you're seeing is dead stuff. Because the live stuff is underneath, which you can't see. So for me, that was a helpful asupa to teach the monks. See the most beautiful supermodel walking in, the most handsome, cute, hot guy coming in. All you're seeing is dead stuff. So that's for me the asupa. So, but all the other parts of the body, and also the postures, especially the postures, that had to be with satipanya, with wisdom. Because you know why you are walking. So that woman who was too late, she was walking not to be mindful of her body, but to get to the lectern, have compassion and respect for all the people who are waiting for her. So please know why you're doing things. Even when you're talking, why are you talking? That is your mindfulness practice. And if you knew why you were talking, much of the talking would stop immediately. What a waste of time it is. Why are you doing it? So before you open your mouth to talk to your friends or to talk to anybody, just contemplate, why am I saying this? I usually ask people on a retreat, if they are going to practice noble silence in a monastery, if they're going to keep quiet, because a meditation monastery, if you want to talk to somebody, just ask yourself, first of all, you have to do the three tests before you open your mouth. The first test, the question you ask is, if this really important? You know, sampajanya, having some wisdom. Do I really need to say this? And if you think, yes, you've passed the first test, then the second test, is this really, really important? That's the second test. If you said, yeah, it is really, really important, then you can go to the third question. Is it really, really, really important? And if it's really, really, really important, and you pass that test, then you can speak. Usually by that time the person's gone, so you're quiet anyway. That's how I encourage people to keep noble silence. But other people on retreats, it's not noble silence, it's stupid silence. And I'll tell you now the difference between noble silence and stupid silence. That sometimes in Australia we have snakes, we have bushfires, there are dangers there. And sometimes on retreats, somebody sees a snake. But they can't say anything, it's noble silence. So they start to mime. And how stupid that is. So in noble silence, if there's something that really needs to be said, look out, there's a snake over there. Say it. Look out, there's a fire. Say it. Don't try and mime it, to keep your mouth closed. So that is called stupid silence. Noble silence is not never speaking, but speaking at the right time, the right place, with the right reasons. With sampajanya. With satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom. Then, your speech is correct. The same with mindfulness wisdom when sleeping. You know, it's the translations. When you actually look at the Pali translations, sometimes people don't translate accurately. Because in that part of the Satipatthana, it says nidhe, being mindful nidhe, which means in sleep. It doesn't mean while falling asleep. That's a totally different word. That's the thing, nidang okamati. Sorry, that's sute. Sute is the word for sleep. Nidang okamati means falling asleep. Or he falls asleep, she falls asleep. Sutta means while asleep. And I thought, how can you be mindful while asleep? While you're asleep, you're asleep, you're unconscious. So what it doesn't mean while you're asleep, what it means is you know the purpose, mindfulness and wisdom, why sleep is important. So you sleep if your body is tired. And I know this personal experience. I do work hard. You know, giving a talk, doing interviews takes a lot of energy. It's just the nature. So if I am giving a retreat, naturally I sleep more. And if I don't sleep enough, I feel very tired. And it can't really perform well. You're not on top of your abilities. But when I go on retreat, when I don't have to do anything at all, when I don't talk to anybody, just staying, I've got a cave where I live, you hardly sleep at all. You don't need it. All it is just you understand the purposes and how much you need. You're mindful and wise enough to sleep the right amount. And that doesn't stay the same every day throughout the year. Sometimes you're even sick. You've got a virus or some other stuff going on in your body and you need to sleep more. I listen to my body. I'm mindful of it. And you know, quite frankly, you ask many of the monks who live with me, you ask Ajahn Brahmani when he comes here, you know, of all the monks, we've got over 20 monks in Bodhinyana, I'm one of the most healthy. I never go to see the doctor. I haven't seen the doctor actually for 25 years. I haven't needed to. Very healthy. Other monks get sick. I tend not to. But you know, there are times, you know, you had a good sleep at night. In the afternoon, you got some free time and you feel that your body's not right. That's what I can say. It's tired. It's weak. And so I'm mindful enough and I listen to my body. One way of being mindful is I ask a question. If you ask a question of your body, you get an answer. I say, you know, what do you want, body? And sometimes my body said, I want some exercise. So I take it for some vigorous exercise, a nice fast walk somewhere, or my walking meditation path. And sometimes I ask that question, how are you, body? What do you want? And it says, I want to rest. And I never argue with my body. I say, you've rested enough already. You're a monk. You can rest when you're in your coffin. Now you meditate. I used to do that. Never works. Now I listen to my body. And it's amazing. This is not indulgence. Because I've done that. I said, okay, I'm going to follow you. And I go back, lay down. If your body needs to sleep, you go to sleep immediately almost. You lay down and within a few seconds you're fast asleep. And you wake up and you feel so good. What's happened? There was some sickness there, some cold, some virus. The body said, look, I need a rest. That's the way I can deal with this. So I rest, get out of the way. And the body does its thing. My wisdom is I work with my body, never against it. Practicing mindfulness of the body for long enough now, I understand it. Understand that sometimes that its health depends on rest, sometimes it depends on exercise, sometimes it depends on eating this, eating that. Even simple things. Remember when I went from pilgrimage to India the very first time as a lay person in 1972. That's right, just made my own way to India overland. And that was wonderful in those days. 1972, there's hardly anyone in Bodh Gaya. Even in the Indian tourist office, I asked the way to Kusinara, no one knew where it existed. So I actually missed out on Kusinara and never got there because I couldn't find out where it was. And even Bodh Gaya was just so calm and peaceful, hardly any pilgrims there at all. But anyway, as soon as I arrived in India, I'd come through Pakistan, I'd eaten something and had very bad diarrhea. So I just stayed in the hotel for a day or two. And because I never had anything to eat, the people in the hotel, I think in Amritsar or somewhere, thought I was a holy man because I didn't eat. But just as soon as I could get out of the bed and, you know, stopped going to the toilet, I had this craving for salt. Just a craving for salt. I didn't know why. So I just staggered to the opposite side of the road, bought a big bag of salt, which was easily available, and just crunched it and ate it as much as I could. And I didn't know why, but I followed my body. And later on I learned that when you have diarrhea, it's not just you losing water, it's your bodily salts. My body was telling me I needed salt. And I followed that advice. Now, a lot of times your body is smart and wise. If you have sati sampajana of your body, you become quite healthy and avoid a lot of problems. It tells you what you need and what you do, what to do. So even sleeping, sati sampajana on your body. But the purpose of it is, you can say, for comfort and well-being, but it's much more than that. That's what lay people do. It's for understanding the Dhamma. To understanding it's just a body, not me, not mine, not a self. And the way you do that is to understand the Samudaya Dhamma and the Vaya Dhamma of each of these Satipatthanas. And again, sometimes the way Satipatthana is taught is the reason why you don't achieve enlightenment within 7 days, because they keep calling that rise and fall, rise and fall, rise and fall. That's not what it means. If you look in a Satipatthana Samyutta, I think that's also number 42. Origination, explaining what Samudaya and Vaya means in the context of the four Satipatthanas. It doesn't mean rise and fall, it means the cause. And why those things cease. That's the Vaya Dhamma. The Samudaya Dhamma of the body is explained as the four aharas, the four nutriments. Why does the body come into being? Why is it sustained? The four nutriments, the four aharas, physical food, contact, basically experience, will, and consciousness. Those are the four things which sustain and cause the body to exist. Just like the oil, the wick, and the heat of the lamp cause the flame to exist. That is what we're supposed to be seeing with our satipanya, with our mindfulness and wisdom. That this body, if you stop eating, it dies. If you stop experience, it dies. If your mother or father go in a coma, sometimes you think that they're not there anymore. Many people have come out of the coma and have told me that they hear everything which is being said. Only they can't say that they're hearing. They can even see, but they can't let the doctor know that they can see. Their perception or their activity is only one where they can receive information but can't do anything back. Like they're frozen and stuck. So they're not dead. But if you think they are dead and don't speak to them, don't hold their hand, don't give them something important, then, not having pasa, they die. It's an important part. So if you do want your loved one, father or mother, tell this to your relations, if you want them to continue living, just hold their hand, speak to them, stimulate their five senses if you want them to stay alive. Otherwise, they will die. Because pasa is one of the important aharas. And the other one, of course, the next one, will. The will to live. If you take away the will to live, like many people do, they've had enough, they're old, or they're somebody that's so disappointed, sometimes they can be in hospital, nothing wrong with them, and they die anyway. The will to live, if you take that away, many people die. And lastly, of course, the consciousness itself. If the consciousness leaves the body for too long, then you die. Before our harvest. So this is where your body comes from, just like the flame and the wick, the oil and the heat. So it is not permanent, it's not you, it's just a body doing its thing. That is what is supposed to be the Samudaya Dhamma and the Vaya Dhamma. Check it out, it's the 42nd sutta in the Satipatthana Samyutta. And that changes a lot of what the Satipatthana is. You're seeing cause and effect, a dependent origination, just in tiny things of body. And the same with experiences. It's experience. You know, all the happiness and suffering and in between which people feel. You know, what is the cause of that? And again, it's just passa. You know, this is just having senses. Senses are sensitive. And that is the cause. The passa stops and all of the vedana stops too. That's what you experience in jhana. There's no passa for the sight, for the sound, smell, taste, touch. The passa is finished. Therefore the vedana finishes. And that gives you the other great, wonderful insight that even the sukha vedana of the five senses is suffering. People take, if you have beautiful sights like Bandra Vela, during the nice sunny afternoons, isn't it beautiful? It's not as beautiful as when your sense of sight stops. Having gorgeous food or having sex, oh how wonderful that must be. It's not as beautiful as when the body sense vanishes. Oh, that is the best. So the highest pleasure of the five senses is when they disappear. So you actually see what the passa is actually is suffering. The Buddha says that many times. So you understand where this passa comes from. Or sorry, rather where this vedana comes from and how it ceases. And understanding because it comes from causes, it doesn't come from you. The vedana is out of control. It'll be wonderful if you can always have happiness and joy all the time. And you always enjoy monastic life. It's just bliss every moment. That your body, because you have the right medicines and a good doctor, never has any aches and pains. It's always nice and peaceful. And all the Dhamma talks you hear are always just exactly what you want to hear. Not things. That's not right. Sometimes listen to a Dhamma talk. You can't make it happiness all the time. Sometimes it will be suffering. Because that is the nature of vedana. Totally out of your control. And that's so wonderful to realize that. I haven't made a mistake when the vedana is suffering. I don't need to fix it. Just like the story of the driverless bus. Sometimes your bus experiences a lot of suffering. Sometimes a lot of happiness. It's not anyone's fault. It's just nature. It's just vedana, that's all. So stop complaining to the bus driver. Stop complaining to anybody. Stop complaining to yourself, stupid monk, suffering again. It's nature. If you have a sense, it's going to have happiness and suffering. You can't have one without the other. They always come together. That was really important for understanding what a waste of time heaven is. You can't have happiness ever after. Impossible. Sooner or later, even heaven has to be suffering. And in fact, even the Christians understood this in their theology. Well, I forget which Christian it was. I think it was St. Augustine. He said, in heaven, this is Christian heaven, you know, which is eternal. They said, in Christian heaven, one day a year, you go to hell. Just for one day. Otherwise, you wouldn't appreciate heaven. And that was actually very wise. If you're just heaven all day, all day, all day, you get used to it. It'll be ordinary. Actually, in our modern world, it is pretty much like heaven. Sometimes the Mahayana talk about the Pure Land. This is the Pure Land. in the Pure Land, this is the Mahayana Sutta, if you want to hear any music, you can just hear it straight away. You can do that on an iPhone, just like in the Pure Land. Any food you want, you can get it straight away. It's called like home delivery. You ring up the pizza house and they deliver it to your house. You want any entertainment? You've got people in the Layla, they've got so many, 65 channels, they said, I think that was a few years ago, probably got more now, on Star Channel or something. 65, you can, whatever you want to hear, any movie. Welcome to the Pure Land. You're already here. So I tell the Mahayana, you don't have to go just chanting Amitofu. You know, you're already here, you've done that. So now you can get enlightened, okay? People don't like me for that, but anyway. It's nice being a monk like me because I've upset enough people already. I always say because, you know, I was thrown out of Wat Pa Phong for ordaining bhikkhunis. So what a wonderful thing that is. Once you've been excommunicated, you're only excommunicated once. Now you're free. Anyway, it wasn't really excommunication. They didn't know how to do it properly. Thank goodness. So with Vedana, you can't control it. It's just Vedana, that's all. So you're suffering, don't complain. You're happy, don't indulge in it. It's just nature. It's not me, not mine. So you don't crave, you don't have ill will. And the jitta, the next Satipatthana. You know that it says in the Satipatthana, I have to go on a bit longer to finish it this time. In the Satipatthana, in the chitta, it says that you know the mind in jhana, or you know the mind with hindrances. And as soon as I saw that, hang on a minute. If I've got hindrances, if I'm sloth and torpor, how can I know I've got sloth and torpor? Sloth and torpor hides everything. How many times have you had sloth and torpor and you thought, oh, I'm really still. I'm so still, I can't experience anything. It must be fourth jhana, like that stupid lady with Ajahn Tate. She was just falling asleep, that wasn't fourth jhana. But it's so still. So, difficult, if you've really got deep sloth and torpor, to know where you are. So, because of that, I always thought that sometimes the mindfulness, pachawekana, jhana, it knows what was happening. You can look back on experiences and go, yeah, I was asleep. I had sloth and torpor. It's interesting, important to know. Because how can you have great mindfulness and know that you're in jhana? If that thought comes up, I am in jhana, you're not. Those perceptions just do not exist there. They certainly exist afterwards. I know I was in jhana. It's awareness of the jitta. Now, those are the extremes. You know, the hindrances or the jhanas. But of course, there's lots in between. Just like when the Buddha taught breath meditation, know the long breath, know the short breath. What about the in-between breaths? He never mentioned them. And they're actually much more common than the long or short. This is just the nature of language. You can't be that precise. So when it says in the chitta, Satipatthana, it is knowing just how much hindrances are there, or how peaceful the mind is. And that is why I introduced the peaceometer. Give it another name if you like. That works in the West. Look at your mind, how peaceful is it? How tranquil is it? You noticed in the five ways of abandoning unwholesome thoughts. The Vitakka Santana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. One of those ways, the fourth way, is to calming the Chitta Sankara. That's the fourth way of, you know, stopping unwholesome thoughts. And that is actually what we do when you actually just look at the peaceometer. You know, it's the underlying so tranquility of your mind. Because if your mind is very tense and agitated, that's where you get the thoughts from. I did give a simile, which again is a very good simile, which I invented, of the guitar string. Because, you know guitars, they're very taut, and then you touch it and you get a sound, a very high-pitched sound. You loosen the tension, you get a lower-pitched sound. You release the tension altogether, you touch the same guitar string, and it does not sound at all. The guitar string is simile for your mind. How tense is it? How stretched is it? If it's really stretched, somebody touches it, you get thoughts. Lots of thoughts, if it's very tense. If it's very, very loose, somebody touches it, and you hardly get a thought at all, or no thoughts. Someone bangs the door, you're very tense, you get lots of thoughts. You're very relaxed and loose, just come out of a jhana, someone bangs the door, doesn't echo in your mind at all. No thoughts. Understanding that simile understands that fourth part of the how to calm the thoughts down. You calm your mind down, you calm the citta sankhara down, and the thoughts usually vanish. Forget about the thoughts. What's underneath them? What's the reason for the cause for them? So once you understand and you know just the citta, you understand the what especially, that's just to start off with, but the main part of it, to understand, just enlightenment, is how does the citta arise? How does it pass away? Cease. And you just look at that little sutta, the number 42 in the Satipatthana Samyutta, and you find the causes nama-rupa. When nama-rupa arises, then the citta arises. When nama-rupa ceases, the citta ceases. It's not always there. I assumed when I was young that the citta, the mind, is always there, only sometimes there's nothing's happening on it. Just again, the simile I gave of the TV. TV's always there, but I haven't turned it on. But that is not what the Buddha said. The Buddha said if there's no program on the TV, the TV vanishes. The TV's just not there. It's not a blank screen. It's gone. When there's nama-rupa, there's something on the citta, something to watch, something to know, then the citta arises. When the nama-rupa ceases, it's gone, nothing on the TV, then the TV vanishes. It's simply not there. And when you understand that, whoa, great! Now I know that the citta is not me, not mine, or the self. It's anicca, it comes and goes. It arises and is subject to cessation. Whatever is of nature to arise is the subject to cease without remainder. That's the citta. It's not me that's listening to this talk. It's not a person who knows the Dhamma. It's just an empty process, arising and passing away. Nama-rupa comes, the citta arises. Nama-rupa ceases, the citta vanishes. Where does it go? It goes nowhere. It's just not there anymore. Where does the flame go when it goes out? It goes nowhere. It just goes out, that's all. And lastly, the Dhamma objects. Now, some of my friends, people like, again, Bhumali Analia, especially Ajahn Analia, he's doing some amazing research, a German monk, comparing all the different versions of these Satipatthana Samyutta available, all the different manuscripts. Because we've just got one manuscript which we usually follow in Theravada. But some of those manuscripts in the early days of Buddhism were translated into Chinese, into Sanskrit. And the earliest manuscript, you'd always say, would be the most simple. And the most simple part of the Satipatthana Sutta only had two objects in the fourth Satipatthana, the Dhammanupassi. And so it's pretty good argument that in the very earliest days, in the time of the Buddha, there's only two things you would focus on in the fourth Satipatthana. And that was the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. The other ones were just not there, added later. And I actually concur with that. It makes a lot of sense. These other ones, there's nothing wrong with them. But then they're extra to how the Buddha wanted us to practice Satipatthana. to actually to be aware and mindful of what these hindrances are and how they arise. And how they arise, their cause is manasikara, attention. You give attention to lustful thoughts and they get stronger and stronger and stronger. You take attention away, what I would say, put some space between you and those lustful thoughts, so you don't get entangled in them. Then they fade away. You're not giving them full attention. That's full attention. All I can see is my hand. That's actually lessening the attention when I can see other things as well. So that's how to overcome lust and desire. Ill will. Don't get obsessed with ill will. And you see the other part of a person. Not just the two bad bricks in the wall of that person, but all the beautiful stuff they've done. Then you can't really get angry at anybody. You can't get angry at life. So you're taking the attention away. So this is with the hindrances. You're aware of the hindrances, what causes them. And when those causes are removed, the hindrances disappear. That is one of your main tasks in meditation. Not to get jhanas, not to attain things, but to let go of things. What? To let go of the five hindrances. Really, that's all you need to know. Let go of the hindrances. The more the hindrances disappear, the more you experience these stages of meditation, like nimittas and jhanas. When they really go forever, then you can have the seven enlightenment factors. So you know how much of those enlightenment factors have been developed. That is what you're aware of. You know their causes. Manasikara. Paying attention to them. Making that important. And those seven enlightenment factors, too much to talk about now. A great topic for tomorrow morning. I think that's enough for today. Seven enlightenment factors, the bodhyangas. Yeah, bodhyangas. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. If I give you too long a talk, then you find out that you just get constipated. Too much food. Indigestion. Very good. So now there are some interviews. So please come as soon as possible, because I usually have to finish at 5:30 to get a rest.